Some of the people most concerned about climate change live on the edge, like the edge of the ocean where rising sea levels could imperil life and property, or the edge of habitable space, as in the Arctic Circle. A Medford man with a long history in Alaska recently returned from Arctic Village, Alaska. Dennis Specht is a volunteer with the Alaska Wilderness League. He'll talk about climate change on the front lines Tuesday at the Medford Library, presented by Southern Oregon Climate Action Now, or SOCAN. And Dennis is in our studio right now. Dennis, welcome.
Good morning, Jeff.
So tell us about Arctic Village, Alaska. This sounds like the end of the earth to some of us, I imagine, but it's home to a number of people, and you were up there recently.
In late July, I went up there for a 10-day visit, my first time to visit old friends, people I met 25 years ago when I lived in Alaska, and I've been doing advocacy and education on their behalf for about 15 years now as a volunteer. The purpose of the trip was to do research into what it's like for my friends living on the edge of climate change, the front lines, and a preview of coming attractions for our neighborhood. Examples are, it's raining all summer long these days, and so they don't have any predictable weather, and with all of that rain, the permafrost is melting, the riverbanks fall into the rivers, silting the rivers, preventing the fish that the people rely on for part of their food from getting up the river. Warmer temperatures mean that brush along the migration of the porcupine caribou herd that used to be below your knee is now growing over your head, impeding and making that migration route much more difficult, forcing the caribou to take other more risky river crossings, for example.
Now, the caribou herd is of extreme importance, I understand, to the Gwich'in people who live in northern Alaska and in far northwest Canada as well. It seems like the interdependence is somewhat similar to Native Americans in the lower 48 and the buffalo herds more than 150 years ago.
The comparison with the bison that roamed our Great Plains a century ago is the most appropriate. However, we weren't wise enough to look after that miracle that was unique in this half of the world. And today, if you want to see bison, you go to a national park, a museum, or a ranch, because those wild herds traveling their traditional routes are gone. The porcupine caribou herd is like the Serengeti of America. This is the last large herd of migratory animals that travel their traditional route in North or South America. The porcupine caribou herd travel a distance close to 3,000 miles twice in a year, a distance equivalent from, say, Maine to Florida. First, they leave the forests in the Canadian Yukon and travel overland, again close to 3,000 miles, to the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and they drop their calves there. This is a special area where the traditional predators, wolves and bears, can't dig their dens due to permafrost, and so it's a safe place for the caribou to drop their babies. There's no backup coastal plain or other area for them to go to if this is spoiled by destructive practices of resource extraction, oil drilling in particular. If you have a spill on the Arctic coast, it's game over for the caribou herd and where they drop their calves.
Dennis Specht, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a volunteer with the Alaska Wilderness League. We're talking about life in the Arctic Circle, Arctic Village, Alaska, specifically where he visited recently. He'll be talking about his experiences there Tuesday evening at the Medford Library. And there's this other film as well, Being Caribou, that'll be presented at the Jacksonville Library, the Medford Library, and the Ashland Library, September 5, 6, 7, all at 6:30. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your thoughts about climate change and its effect on places like Alaska, these remote parts of the world where the climates are already extreme. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So Dennis, what sent you up to Arctic Village? What made you decide to take this trip?
Because I've been friends with these people for quite some time and doing this kind of advocacy, it was time for me to go and visit them and be their guest. And I was treated like a VIP. I got in touch with the principal of the school. The village has 150 people, and mentioned that I have friends who could round up some school supplies and bring donations. He said, no, I get that easily enough in Fairbanks, a two-hour flight away. He requested some specific things for his students because the reality is this village is 110 miles north of the Arctic Circle. There's no road system. There is no mill, no stores, no economy. So when the kids finish school, there's no jobs. And so the choice is to stay in the village without employment or to run away to Fairbanks or Anchorage and lose connection with the family and the culture, which is always a sad thing. I lived in Alaska over 20 years, and I saw these examples of the natives who came into the cities, and they didn't have a cultural connection to support them. So specific items the principal asked for were things that the kids could make craft projects out of and perhaps sell. And so a hard one was 80 pounds of recycled bandsaw blades that he could teach them to make knives. I had to visit five different sawmills. I hit the jackpot with Boise Cascade in Medford. They found a volunteer who cut the old blades to 11.5-inch length so I could put them in flat-rate shipping boxes. And Boise Cascade generously donated the labor and 80 pounds of steel that I shipped to the Arctic close to a month and a half ago. A friend in Jacksonville donated a mahogany 2x4, 16 feet long, that he bucked to length of the shipping box. So he sent them some hardwood for woodcrafting projects. The most obscure, I believe, was Terry, the principal, asked for obsidian because he'd like to teach the kids how to make spear points and knives like their ancestors did from volcanic stone. Well, I met a man who owns an obsidian mine. It turns out Oregon has the third largest deposit of obsidian in the world. And so I was able to bring everything from raw stone to blanks that had been sawn to shape for spear points or knives, the tools to do the flint napping and making the edge. A how-to book was donated by that miner, and he also suggested that I round up some Band-Aids, which I did bring a big Ziploc bag full of Band-Aids, because when you flake obsidian, it's like glass. So I gave them everything from start to finish to be able to make these stone tools. The principal was so surprised that I had rounded up everything on his wish list. He made the use of his four-wheeler available to me to get around the village because there aren't cars there. And I got to stay at the school where they have showers and flush toilets. That's how remote this is. It's the only place in town that has a shower or running water.
So you mentioned the concerns about oil drilling in the Arctic Ocean. How close is that to happening, and what about the protections of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge?
Well, the Gwich'in have mobilized in the 80s when it was first mentioned to drill oil in that area, in that vulnerable area. And they came together, all of the villages came together and signed a unanimous resolution against drilling in the Arctic and drawing on documents from the United Nations definition of cultural genocide as being cultural genocide can be defined as depriving an indigenous culture access to their traditional way of life or food. The Gwich'in, their name means people of the caribou, because 80% of their food come from caribou. So you destroy where the caribou have the drop their babies, you destroy the food source, and it's the end of that culture. It is cultural genocide. So they've mobilized unanimously through the Canadian Yukon and the Alaskan villages to take a stand against drilling in the Arctic. One thing that makes these people unique in this half of the world is they were the last indigenous people to be contacted after Columbus arrived in the 15th century. Number one, because they were so far away in the far north. And number two, they didn't have anything anybody wanted to exploit or rip off until they discovered oil and gas. This is the purest subsistence-based culture in North America because of their dependence on living off of the land. That's what subsistence means.
Let's take a call here. We have Vince and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about climate change in the Arctic with Dennis Specht.
Yes, I was just wondering if the speaker had any more information or experience with this huge patch of unusually warm water off the Alaskan coast, well, the whole Pacific coast down to Mexico. and the toxins that it's producing and how it's moving up the food chain. And the 800-pound gorilla in the room question about overpopulation and how it's affecting the weather and the environment in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you, Vince. Appreciate it. So the warm water blob, any mention of that in your discussions with the folks in the Gwich'in?
No, it's useful to point out that Alaska is 20% the size of the lower 48. So with a state that huge, we have many different ecosystems. Where the Gwich'in are located is northeast Alaska, next to the Canadian border, quite far away from the seacoast, where we're influenced by the currents you mentioned, the Japanese current in particular, that has a tempering influence on the west coast of Alaska. I'm aware of that issue, but this was not of concern to the people living in the interior, 100 miles south of the Arctic Ocean and more than 1,000 miles from the Pacific coast of Alaska.
So what figures to happen up here? I noticed that there's quite a bit of activity involving drilling in the Arctic Ocean of late. There was the whole icebreaker rig that came through Portland, the protests by Greenpeace in an effort to stop that. It looks like there are bits of legislation in Congress, including from Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley, to try to stop drilling in the Arctic Ocean. I mean, what's the general picture you can give us here, Dennis?
Senator Merkley's bill, which was announced in July to ban offshore drilling in the Arctic permanently, is the first of its kind. He deserves our gratitude for taking a leadership role in an institution where we don't see leadership often enough. We have yet to see if our senior senator, Ron Wyden, will join Senator Merkley as a strong supporter. That's part of the work that I'll be doing at my lectures to inform people that constituent communication with Senator Wyden would be very useful at this time to motivate him in the right direction. Because I've been involved in this issue for 15 years, I can recall that back when we had a Republican Senator, Gordon Smith, a bunch of pesky activists like myself made sure that Senator Smith received more communication on this issue of stopping drilling in the Arctic than any other for years at a stretch, and it worked. So we have the leadership example of Merkley's bill to ban offshore drilling in the Arctic. Greenpeace's protests in Portland most recently were to stop that icebreaker on its way to support Shell's effort in the Chukchi Sea. That's not the Arctic. It's right around the corner. It's between Siberia in Russia and western Alaska. So it's not the same patch that is putting the caribou calving grounds at risk, but still, the day after Obama signed the final permit, some of us are aware that Hillary came out with a statement that it's not worth the risk. Well, if some of you saw the visual images of Shell's drill rig in Seattle dwarfing the Space Needle behind, the first word that came to mind for me when I saw that was obscene. Obscene. Because I'm aware that the process has been rigged, that since 1918, oil and gas industries have monopolized over 80% of the government subsidies available to energy producers. So the playing field is so far out of level that oil and gas industries make a profit if they don't find oil, if they do find oil, or if they spill the oil, they still make money, and we middle-class taxpayers subsidize that. If the playing field were level, where everyone got the same or none, our country would go in the direction of alternative energy sources tomorrow.
How do you counter the idea of the Arctic as a wasteland, though? I went looking for examples of members of Congress who were holding up the blank white pages and saying, this is what the Arctic looks like, and I found multiples. It was more than one. It's been said a lot on the floor of Congress, either house. This is what the Arctic looks like. So how do you counter that perception of this vast wasteland where nothing's going to get hurt?
Well, if people would like to see that counter, turn out 6 o'clock Tuesday night. I brought back videos that I shot myself of this area. And it was Alaska's Senator Frank Murkowski who first made that statement on the floor of the Senate, holding up a blank piece of paper and saying, what does it look like? It looks like this. Well, some of our elected representatives at times have issues with the truth, and he knew better. but he was a shill for people who gave him big donations. And so the basic tenet of marketing is repetition over and over and over again, and the gullible will believe that there's nothing there. Well, as a former Alaskan, I'm candid enough to say that that's a lie. I've been there. I've seen the environment.
You had your own impact from the Exxon Valdez spill, didn't you?
I lived through Exxon Valdez as a victim and a witness. I ran tugboats on Prince William Sound for the two following summers. And frequently, media does not have the resource to assign people to do deep reporting on issues like that, and they swallow up and repeat industry statements. Exxon reported that they had spilled 11 million gallons of oil. Well, the people who did the survey on the wreck while it was still high and dry on Bly Reef after the collision were from my town. I used to be a commercial scuba diver, and I used to fill my air tanks at CNC Dive Shop, husband and wife operation. When Cecil and Corrine understood that Exxon was reporting 11 million gallons, they got out their original notes from the survey they did, commissioned by Exxon. And on the kitchen table, they did their own math and discovered that the spill was 33 million gallons. Exxon had gotten away with underreporting by 60%.
Almost out of time. When is your event at the Medford Library?
6 p.m. this coming Tuesday, August 25th. It's free and open to everyone. And I'm bringing back personal videos that I shot myself.
All right. Dennis Speck, just back from Arctic Village, Alaska, recently. He is a volunteer with the Alaska Wilderness League. Thanks so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.